we are all human beings, and conversation is part of the thing that keeps us going.
Willie Whitelaw said, well, he said, if you can't agree, he said, I have to produce a coin out of my pocket.
He didn't make friends very easily, and he was very quick at making enemies.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Michael Barton.
I was a wartime child. I was about 8 when the war began. We were being bombed pretty early on, 40, 41. Most of the schools took their kids to neighbouring schools and villages around East Yorkshire. That was my background. I was always at a school evacuated, either in Market Wheaton or Pocklington. And my brother and I were staying in a rented house next to a carrot field. And my father said, this would be nice and safe, you won't have any problems there. Going to school every day. Well, within about 2 weeks, the carrot field suddenly became an RAF runway. So radio started very early for me, because no television, of course. You took a radio down into the dugout with you, a battery-operated radio, with an accumulator battery that weighed a ton and which you could only have charged up at the local garage. So that was how I first got my love affair with radio, listening to Forces favourites, the Red Cross Radio Contest, which was identifying sound effects. I kept a cutout book, which I've still got somewhere today, of people who are radio names, like Ronnie Warman doing the Red Cross Radio Contest, and Rob Wilton and all the rest of it.
The day war broke out, my missus looked at me and she said, what good are you? I said, how do you mean, what good am I? Well, she said, you're too old for the army. You couldn't get into the Navy and they wouldn't have you in the Air Force, so what good are you?
Of course, there were all quizzes which we used to listen to on Sunday lunchtimes and things like Have a Go with Wilfred Pickles. There's a prominent Yorkshireman at the time doing a travelling quiz show, going around to pubs and working men's clubs and all that sort of thing, with his quiz, which was largely a sort of crosstalk with members of the audience and gagging all the way through it and having a bit of fun. And people who got to the end of the quiz were given a prize, a few bob. And his wife was called Mabel, and he used to say, well, give them the money, Mabel.
I do. How are you?
But I particularly, of course, because it was wartime, was absolutely involved in all the live reporting from the front. So we're now talking about Frank Gillard, whose name comes up in local radio much later on, as a wartime correspondent, out in the trenches in Normandy and North Africa, working very closely with Montgomery. Those guys, under Godfrey Talbots, all had to take massive heavy gear around with them, disc recorders, and extremely heavy and cumbersome to operate. So lying in a ditch, probably with your feet in water, and trying to keep this bulky piece of equipment in the dry and working, and then having recorded your dispatch, to get on a motorbike and get somebody to take you to a distant studio, a French studio, to play it down the line back to Broadcasting House in London. I mean, those were just amazing times. And the power of those descriptions has stayed with me today. I mean, I remember a line of Frank Gillard's, who became my boss as managing director of radio. Well, I'm lying here in a cornfield, and he was in Normandy. It was D-Day, just D-Day plus one. And he could see parachutes landing all around him.
I'm lying down at full length here in the cornfield. Just in the hedges around me, I can see many men taking shelter behind the banks wearing their steel helmets while the terrific barrage goes on around us. In this barrage, we've got our 4.2-inch mortars, our field guns, our medium guns.
In your sitting room, you would have more than likely a wooden radio set, probably with a sunburst cut out in fretwood across the front of it, a glowing light that showed you a range of radio stations, all old-fashioned medium wave, of course, or maybe long wave, with Hilversum being prominent on the dial. To a child, Hilversum was like something out of a fairy tale. You know, what was Hilversum? Well, it happened to be a Dutch radio station, but it was always it's always stuck in my mind. And then there was Luxembourg. And you came to Luxembourg, and it was, we are the Ovaltinis, little girls and boys. So we were listening to commercial radio stations from abroad. And Luxembourg was a great listen to a child because of these clubs they had for children. And you could write in for competitions and so on.
And I've decided to award an Ovaltini Certificate of Merit. So if you have done something extra special, say in the way of running, jumping, swimming, or unbroken attendance at school, please write and tell me about it.
Before I left school, I wrote to the BBC and said, any chance of a job? Which is a bit cheeky, because I had no idea what kind of a job I would want or even be offered at the age of 17, probably most unlikely. But to my amazement, I got a letter from the appointments department saying, would you like to come for an interview in London? I mean, anybody from Hull going to London for an interview to the BBC was unheard of. So I appeared in Portland Place, and the appointments officer was a chap called Anthony Craxton, who became producer of all the Queen's Royal broadcasts, Christmas Day broadcasts and so on. He was a very, very BBC, and he spoke like that, and he had suede shoes. What's more, the suede shoes were not on the floor, they were on the desk, with his feet in them, leaning back, with his fingers crossed over his chest. I think very much as if, I don't know why I'm doing this here, I'll keep this child amused. Now, Michael, why is it you like to join the BBC? And I started to stammer and stutter my way through. And within 2 minutes, he'd said to me, well, you won't get anywhere in the BBC with that Yorkshire accent of yours. And I said, well, OK, if I get rid of my Yorkshire accent, what shall I? He said, well, go into the army and go and see the world. And that was the end of that, or so I thought. I did go into the army, spent time in Germany doing my national service, came back, got a job with Smith & Nephew in Hull, the people who make elastoplast. So I was a copywriter. That was my first proper job. But out of the blue, while I was there, I got a letter from the BBC. They had kept my name on file from the interview I had when I was 17, and said, there's a vacancy for a studio manager at the BBC studios in Leeds. Are you interested? Now, that was 17 to the age of about 22, so 5 years. Anyway, that's what happened, and I applied for the job and I got it. And that's how I got into the BBC. We're now talking about 1953, the year of the big floods on the East Coast.
Contributions which are urgently needed for the tens of thousands of flood victims should be sent to the Lord Mayor, Mansion House, London, EC4, and they should be marked National Flood and Tempest Fund. All are asked to give as much as they can afford and as quickly as possible.
And I arrived in Woodhouse Lane in Leeds in the old Friends Meeting House, which was the then BBC centre. No television at that point in time, it was all radio. And I was putting on brass bands, doing live spot effects for radio plays. Leeds was a very major centre for radio drama. So that was quite testing for, you know, a youngster, having to get all the spot effects right first time. No takes, no retakes, no second chances. On 1953, of course, was a significant year for television because suddenly overnight the coronation delivered television sets. And I remember in Leeds watching the coronation on a Bakelite black and white set screen, about 12 inches, if that, 9 inches across, flickering picture. For those of us in radio, it was just playing a new game.
For the first time in history, through the medium of television, the ancient and noble rite of a coronation service will be witnessed by millions of Her Majesty's subjects.
It didn't really have any great impact, except the awe of seeing the Queen being crowned and so on. Television was not beckoning to me, and radio was still king. But But of course, the following years were going to be different. I eventually moved to Manchester. Television came in. There were regional programmes. And indeed, the north of England had a lot to offer in terms of television programming. For me, it meant working in the north region as a radio producer, which I had now become, doing Children's Hour, among other things, and documentaries and nightly current affairs programmes. The opportunity to do television came because we were all under one directorate. Imagine having a boss today who is radio and television. But Editor North, as he was then, was both. So he could say, Michael, instead of doing your regular nightly current affairs programme on radio over the next 2 months, I'm going to send you off to do some television documentaries. And it was a terrific opportunity for developing your talents and discovering where you wanted to be. I mean, I spent a lot of my time either in front of a camera or on air, doing presentation programs and so on, doing interviews live on television and so on. Those are the sort of days where experimentation, taking risks with people like me, because I was still only, late 20s, pushing the boat out, those were the good old days. Today, everything is played a bit safe. My boss was a chap called John Tisdall, who was editor of news, and he was approached by Frank Gillard, who was by now managing director of radio, who'd come in from his battle front in the Second World War, became controller West Region, and then he ended up as director of radio in London for the whole of the BBC. And Frank Gillard had this great yen to create local radio stations instead of regional stations. He knew from his own experience in Bristol that the South West was too large an area to cover to mean anything significant to people within that very large stretch. The South West region, the West region, covered from Land's End to Southampton. A massive stretch. So great masses. And Frank had been to America, listened to commercial radio, liked it, liked the localness of it, liked the relevance of it to these more tightly knit communities, and thought this is what's going to work in the UK. So he persuaded the powers that be, and significantly the Pilkington Committee, which was looking at radio at the time. Frank knew he needed to do a lot of hard talking, not only outside the BBC with the politicians, but within it. A lot of resistance to local radio, Toy Town Radio, what the heck are they doing, wasting their money? And Frank set up quite wisely in 1963, thereabouts, a series of experiments, closed circuit experiments, they were never broadcast. I was asked to go to Hull, which is my old hometown, to do an experiment there. Others were taking place in Durham and Poole, down on the south coast, in Norwich, and other places in the country. What Frank was doing, very cleverly, was setting up these small experiments for a few days at a time, recording everything that was done, and he was building up his little archive, which was going to be used in the future, to great effect, to persuade the doubters, the politicians, those with influence, that this is the way forward.
Radio Hull, your local BBC station. The time? 6 o'clock. Well, good morning, it's Michael Barton here in the Guildhall on a rather uncertain
morning.
We were
playing to the gallery with the City Council because we wanted them to be on side. Long-term good investment, you know, when we come to the point of saying, do you want a radio station? And Frank always came to those experiments. I remember looking, I was doing presenting the breakfast programme through the glass. At 7 o'clock in the morning was the managing director of radio, Frank Gillard, bald head, listening attentively and watching the reels of tape going by as they recorded these, the output, which he distilled, and which later I witnessed Frank doing the great sell. And it took place in Broadcasting House in London, in front of an invited audience of town clerks, leaders of the city councils and so on, county council leaders, the police, people of significance and influence around the country. And there were something like 80 or more people in the concert hall, as it used to be called, in Broadcasting House. And I was lucky enough to be there to see Frank, a single figure on stage, no notes, absolutely not a scrap of paper anywhere to be seen, talking to these people about the significance, the relevance, the power of local radio, putting up a mirror to the community. And the reason he was doing it was because, A, he wanted the support, obviously, from around the country, but B, he wasn't going to be able to use the licence fee. They would have to pay for the experiment, which was to take place over 2 years. Now, that's a big ask.
Good morning. Today we have our weekly programme on food news. And here is Angela Beeching talking about the best buys in the Durham shops for this weekend.
By the time he'd finished playing his tapes, his clips, they were queuing up to eat out of his hand. But he knew that he couldn't offer a radio station to a community that could only come up with half the money. And the figure he had in mind is around about £50,000 a year, which in those days was quite a lot of money. And I was asked if I would go to Sheffield, because Sheffield was one of those cities that came up with the full amount, £50,000 for each of 2 years, so a total of £100,000. At the end of which, the decision was going to be taken by government as to whether or not the BBC could go ahead or not. Now, within the BBC, there was still a huge resistance to these upstarts pinching money from network radio or indeed from network television. So I was lucky. I got my money from Sheffield. Meanwhile, up in Durham, which was one of the first eight stations, and not only was it local authority, but it was the police who put in £10,000 for each of the 2 years as a contribution. Why would the police think it was worth paying for a radio station? Well, they knew why, because it was going to serve them well too. And others around the country, like Liverpool and so on, were having similar experiences. Deals were struck with local newspapers. That was a turn-up for the book. Most newspapers thought local radio would kill them off. But in Liverpool, they were doing a deal with the local newspaper to provide the news copy. So there were all sorts of interesting finesses being created around the country as this deal was struck. The difficulty which I then faced going into Sheffield was how to play it. And I decided right from day one that it was going to be a service right across the board, irrespective of background and so on. We didn't know at this stage what the age range would likely to be. I sat down with my team of 15 people, half of whom had come from the BBC and half from the local community, mainly from newspapers or from education backgrounds. I think it was the right approach to have people who knew Sheffield well, Sheffield and the area, and those who had a bit of broadcasting experience. So, but there were only 15 of us, so it was a pretty tight ship, but we were only going to broadcast for about 6 hours a day. So our key times were breakfast, middle of the day, and tea time. That was about it. How did we arrange those programmes? By all my production team and I sitting on the carpet in my flat about 3 weeks before we went on air. It was as last minute as that. Because we'd only been recruited in April, trained in the summer. I also got married in the summer. So this is my golden wedding year as well. And then on air by November. So it's a very, very, very tight schedule. So we sat on the carpet with pieces of paper and ideas flowing around. What should we do? Well, let's start with our current affairs, news and current affairs. And we blocked it out bit by bit. And then we started to add on little extras like a gardening programme and sport happened to be on a Saturday and so on and so on.
My name's Jack Thompson. The day, Wednesday, November the 15th, 1967... The time, 1 minute to six.
There were fun days. There were hair-raising days. And on the first day that we went on air, November the 15th, 1967, Jack Thompson, who had been a teacher in Lancashire, so he was a Lancastrian with no broadcasting experience, the first voice on air reading the news. and the copy said there'd been an accident on the M1, which Jack saw the letter figure 1 and thought it was an I, and he said that we've had an accident with MI. And we all looked at each other and thought, oh God, here we go. At that time, and I think they still exist, the Radiophonic Workshop in London, most famous for its Doctor Who signature tune, doodle-dum, 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 all done with extraordinary instruments and tricks and devices and speeding up of tape and slowing it down. So you can actually create a musical sound as well as, you know, dramatic sound effects. So I thought, well, Sheffield, City of Steel, Cutlery, I wonder if Delia Derbyshire, who was then running the unit, would be able to do something with a knife, fork and spoon. And of course it was an amazing piece of work. I mean, it was not the most memorable tune, and you wouldn't want to take it on your desert island with you, I don't think. But that was the general idea, and we used that to create a bit of publicity for the station in the first place.
This is BBC Radio Sheffield on 88.6 VHF.
We decided we'd do a phone-in on our day one. It was chancy because it was on VHF. And VHF, or FM as we now know it, was only available to 40% of the population. So we did a great sell, or tried to, you know, adverts around the town and so on, to get people to go out and buy FM sets. Well, it's a big request, that, isn't it, to say, well, if you want to hear your new radio station, you'll have to buy a new radio set. So we did a phone-in, and that morning when I went to work, I said to my wife, my new wife, because we'd only just got married, we're doing a phone-in this morning at 10 o'clock, and if nobody rings in, I think you might have to be on standby. Would you think of a decent question to put? And at 10 o'clock, there was Frank Gillard in the studio, and Ian Duthan was going to take over from him, and loads of other people. The presenter said, right, this is the number to ring, 616-185, or whatever. Well, you're on the air. Absolute silence. Not a dicky bird. Nobody. And then suddenly, a voice I recognised. She refused to give her name, thank God. And she said, well, I've only lived in Sheffield for a few weeks, and I really want to get to know how to make some good Yorkshire dishes. I have no idea how to make Yorkshire pudding. So if anybody's got any ideas, I'd like to hear them. Of course, the phones then went mad as people came up with their own favourite ideas about how to make a nice rising Yorkshire pud.
Get your VHF radio, be ready to say. Get Radio Sheffield in our house each day.
And one day, the rabbi, chief rabbi in Sheffield, rang me up and said, I wonder if you could consider doing a bar mitzvah on air. Very special kind of bar mitzvah. And I said, well, why is that? He said, because the boy whose bar mitzvah it is in Moscow. We're now in the middle of the Cold War, of course, in the 60s. His parents are not allowed to leave Moscow, but we're in touch with him, and his father has asked me if there's any way we could give him his bar mitzvah. And I said, well, you mean we would do it here in Sheffield? We had this lovely ballroom which could take an audience and a choir and music, and the missing link, of course, is going to be how we get the boy involved. The answer was a phone call to Moscow by arrangement, knowing that the KGB could pull the plug any second. And the thing is about it, of course, it had to be done live, and it had to be done in the afternoon. But I decided that the only way to get around that was to let all our listeners in on the story. Let them share the excitement with us. So the Jewish community arrives in force, the choir sings, the rabbi is there, and then we're in the control room. My heart is going missing beats. Dialing Moscow in those days? Very difficult. Anyway, we did make the call, and I shall always remember that voice, the boy, His voice hadn't broken. He was still a child. He was on the verge of manhood, and today was his big day. And it moves me to talk about it because it was such an astounding moment. When we went into Sheffield and invited to form this radio station, it was a Labour council. Sheffield had been run by Labour for 40 years. And then the following year, most amazing thing happened, it went Tory for the first time. So and that was, again, part of the fun, you know. Here we are in Sheffield, we've just arrived at this sensational change in fortune, political fortune. I think it was May 1969, when my first child was due to be born. I said very sportingly, I'll produce this election broadcast, and Tim Neal, my number two, much missed, late lamented Tim Neal, who's my number two, and we'll do this programme together, and everybody else will be out and about doing things, and Michael Green will be in the studio, and we'll have an outside broadcast in the town hall and have another one in Rotherham and so on. We got very carried away and off we went. And of course, you always take a chance with any live OBs that the lines will happen when you want them to happen and people will be there with the result when you want them to be, but life isn't like that.
I think we can go over immediately, though, to Ted Gorton with the Handsworth result. Hello, Ted.
Hello, Mike. Yes.
You have the Handsworth result.
Yes, I do.
I have so many very happy memories about, you know, what we did at Sheffield, and I think it was the way in which other people in the community could responded to our invitation to do things. I mean, the churches came in and did a whole series of wonderful broadcasts, regular programmes. We had a lovely old Presbyterian guy called Griffiths. He just took to the microphone like the most natural experience in his life. There was a great surprise when a chap called Chris Hughes was doing the phone-ins on Radio Sheffield. He heard a voice in distress at the end of the phone, and the guy who rang him had been alone trying to manhandle a wardrobe down the stairs, and the wardrobe, unfortunately, had a mind of its own and fell on top of the bloke who was carrying it.
Mr. Savage, hello, Mr. Savage.
Well, Happy Savage here. I'm wondering if any of your listeners in this area could help me.
What's your
At
problem?
At the moment, I am stuck under a wardrobe on the staircase.
You're not.
Yes, the wardrobe has got four hooks on it.
Yeah.
And the hooks have got onto the banister. And I just can't move.
I mean, we had our detractors in Sheffield, of course, and throughout the country. The eight stations got a bit of stick from local newspapers. Some of the other newspapers, the national newspapers, did regard us as toy town radio. I have to confess that if I listened to some of the programmes that went out then, I might colour a little with embarrassment. But even if they didn't work first time round, or even if people sounded amateurish, I knew that time would change all of that, and it did. But yes, we were making mistakes as we went along. That was the whole idea. And when Frank Gillard launched us, his words were these: look, I want you to take every chance in the book. You're on your own. I will not be listening. I can't listen. I live in London. You won't have us breathing down your necks. You're going to create your own radio output. Go ahead and do it. Heaven's sake, take chances. Make mistakes.
And it's on the strength of the assessment that will be made next year that decisions will be taken whether to go ahead with a great expansion of local radio or whether to curtail the operation, perhaps even to cancel what's happened so far.
Well, of course, the 2 years went by like a whirlwind. We were all potentially going to be without a job. We all knew that from the day we went into local radio. So we had 2 years to prove the point. The 2 years came up. Assessments were made. Don't forget, Frank Gillard had by now handed over to Ian Trevithan, because Frank was really launching local radio at the end of his career. Ian Trevithan was an ex-ITN newsreader, appointed by Charles Hill, the chairman of the BBC, a Tory, and Ian had got right-wing leanings, but he appointed him out of the blue to be the next managing director of radio to succeed Frank Gillard. It was an extremely astute appointment because Ian Trethewan, who knew nothing about radio, was exceptionally keen to learn. And he went around these eight stations and he stayed with us in my home in Sheffield. He got right under the skin of the experiment. Amazing bloke. And he was subsequently, as you know, later on in his period as managing director, he always used to take soundings from the staff at the most ordinary level. By that I mean he would cut out his heads of departments and his controllers and have little lunch parties for staff, producers, station assistants, just to keep in touch. Great ploy, however, was that he and Chris Chataway were muckers, mates at ITN, and Chris Chataway became the Postmaster General. This is the Tory government we're now talking about, and it was a testing time. Ian Trethewan, although he would be very circumspect about the kind of conversations he had, undoubtedly used his early friendship with Chataway to help to persuade him that local radio was the way forward. Chataway, of course, had already got in his mind, commercial radio. And he, I think, took some persuading that BBC local radio, with its speech-based output, was not going to be a direct competitor with commercial radio, which is bound to have a stronger, higher level of music output, and that with that appealing to a younger audience. And he was right. The conversation obviously proved fruitful. The BBC internally came to terms with the fact that they were going to have to pay for the local radio out of the licence fee because it was regarded as too chancy to depend upon local authorities committing themselves to a permanent investment in local radio. With what change of politics from left to right? How could that be? How could there be any stability, to use a common word? And there wouldn't have been. So the licence fee was indeed used to fund local radio and its next phase of development.
And now, with the time at 1 o'clock, we come to the end of broadcasting from Radio Hallam for today. We shall be back on the air again at 5 minutes to 5 with the...
One or two people that I knew, like Roger Moffat, who'd been an announcer in Manchester when I was there, and became one of the first presenters on Hallam Radio. I was just about to become controller of local radio and I was moving to London at that time, so I was kind of leaving behind that first year, that love-in between the commercial station and the BBC station. All I can say is about relationships with ILR, both at local level and at national level, because suddenly I was thrust into conversations with the IBA, John Thomson, director of ILR, and the forthcoming planning committee which developed the whole thing. All I can say about that is that we were all in the same box. We were all devoted, commercial radio and BBC local radio, in serving our communities in our different ways. We became good friends. We very quickly formed the Radio Academy between ILR and ourselves, BBC local radio, which has been a fruitful relationship ever since. At national level, John Thomson and I used to plan the next development of stations. BBC only had 8, went on to 12, and then subsequently to cover the whole of the country between us. There were interesting days too. Margaret Thatcher coming in 79, and Willie Whitelaw as the Home Secretary responsible for broadcasting. He was a great fan of local radio because he represented his constituency in Cumbria, and Radio Carlisle was up there and he used to pop in and out of Radio Carlisle. I suppose the most stressful and worrying time was always when somebody from outside comes in to have a look at what you're doing and has the authority, like Lord Annan and the Annan Report, gave at that particular time. Now, the Annan report was just before 78-79. We were already on hold because we'd only got by then 12 radio stations, and Lord Annan came in, took a sniff at what local radio is doing, though he was looking at more than local radio. I mean, I felt I had a huge responsibility to try and convince him and his team that what we were doing was worthwhile. And that's always difficult to people who are not natural members of a community. And he certainly wasn't. I mean, he would have been very uncomfortable, stuck in, I don't know, Stoke-on-Trent, listening to a local radio station for more than 5 minutes. And his team tended to come with a business background. So they would say, for example, why is it that Radio Oxford costs X to run and Radio London costs Y? Why can't they cost the same? I.e., why does Radio London have to cost more money than Radio Oxford? I would have thought the answer was pretty obvious, size being one small consideration. And they tend to think that we're sort of producing cans of beans, and if you produce 10 cans of beans for 50 quid in Oxford, you can do the same thing in Hull or wherever. So that was very frustrating, and then it came to a head when there was a live television debate chaired by Robin Day, and I was invited, along with people from ILR and so on, to go and give our two penneth on why we rated local radio and what were its advantages and so on. And Lord Annan had come up with a crazy solution, and that's really where the stress comes. His solution was that BBC local radio shouldn't be funded out of the licence fee. It should be funded, if people want it, they can. It can be a subscription service. Now, we've all heard the joke about, you know, the American radio station where they go on the air on a Sunday night and say, unless you send us $10 in the post, there'll be no programme tomorrow. Subscription radio would be a disaster. I can't imagine why somebody as so-called sensible and intelligent as Lord Annan would even think of it. But he did, and it was there in his report. So I had to defend the status quo, and he described local radio as being in a mess. Well, the reason it was a mess, in quotes, was because it was only half developed. So those were troubling times, and yeah, I did have sleepless nights because you suddenly feel, well, the buck stops with me, and if I can't persuade people, how am I going to get through the next day? And then I'd work on governors the best I could. The effect that I'd had was quite remarkable because they were much more understanding, ready to be persuaded, and sending them off to a local radio station for a couple of days did help to work the magic a bit. But those were the testing times for me, getting people to see what we're about. And the trouble is that anybody who works in local radio listening to this will know, people who've been brought up in the centre and never had life outside the M25 takes a lot of persuading that there is a real life out there. It's a different life. There are different perspectives, different ambitions, different lifestyles to the one that they enjoy in their apartments in Mayfair.
And the broad approach of the committee has been to say that the BBC ought to concentrate on doing things nationally, that the IBA should concentrate, not exclusively, on doing things regionally. That is why, for example, there is the recommendation to take local broadcasting away from the BBC, with which, of course, we totally disagree.
When we were planning the development, we were obliged not to compete directly with each other in our development. So, for example, there were great swathes of the UK which had no local radio at all. They'd had regional radio, but nothing else. And when it came to deciding who should go into Norwich first, Radio Norfolk, or should it be Broadlands, the ILR station, there was an impasse, and we all went for lunch to a London hotel. John Thompson from the ILR, George Howard, the chairman of the BBC, Willie Whitelaw, Home Secretary, and me. Willie Whitelaw said, well, he said, if you can't agree, you said, I have to produce a coin out of my pocket. So John Thompson and I tossed a coin as to who should go into East Anglia first.
Hello, this is Radio Norfolk, your new neighbour, broadcasting on 351 metres medium wave.
Now, I just happened to have a press cutting, what is it, a press cutting from the Times. It was June 79, I remember that well. BBC local radio to cut broadcasting hours. BBC's 20 local radio stations have been told to reduce their broadcasting hours to help improve the quality of their output and take pressure off overworked staff. I suppose that included me, did it? At present, most of the stations are on air from 6:30 a.m. to 7:30 or 8 o'clock at night. And now, the chap behind this was, I went through how many bosses, managing directors of radio, about six or seven, and one of them was Aubrey Singer. Now, Aubrey had come from television, he didn't really know much about radio, and he was a bull in a china shop. He always wore red braces, by the way, and he sort of walked along the corridor in Broadcasting House, whistling, and at the same time, he's flicking his braces, his red braces, so you heard a... I always knew that was Aubrey coming down the corridor, flap, flap, flap of his braces. And he came into my office one day and he said, how many education producers have you got? I said, well, only one on each station. He said, yes, but if I cut them all, you know, it sounds awful to say 30 posts have gone overnight, but to a station it's only like one post, isn't it? They only feel it, they won't feel it 30 times over. I said, Aubrey, are you saying... you think you'll cut all the education producer posts? He said, well, they don't do very much, do they? He said, we're not an education outfit. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible argument. But that was the way his mind went. So he applied this logic far too many times for my liking. And Aubrey and I did have some very tense times. He also thought that cutting the hours would save a lot of money, whereas in actual fact, it doesn't. But he had this sort of rather impulsive way of wishing to do things. But he didn't make friends very easily, and he was very quick at making enemies. And I had another very bad time with him when he was trying to cut out of all things. He chose the wrong targets. He thought he could save money by killing off the black programme, Black Londoners, at Radio London, a programme which was run on a shoestring. But he just thought it was something that would save a bit of money. He chose the time, and it was, of course, the most treacherous area to go into anyway. And I had to save him from those sort of moments of folly.
And at 7:30, we'll be telling you what's on in London today. At 7:40, we'll be bringing you more travel prospects. And at 7:45, the full London News Bulletin, followed by the local weather forecast.
Travelling around the country, as I did all the time, bus, train, plane, every form. Try and catch up on your listening as you're going around, particularly, of course, in the car. And to me, one of the most outstanding figures in radio history, never mind local radio, was somebody who never had any broadcasting experience. I was called Dennis McCarthy at Radio Nottingham. I was aware of his existence when I was in Sheffield, but I first came across him when I arrived at the station at Radio Nottingham one day, and it was budget day. The fact was that Dennis knew how to work his audience, and I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. He knew how to get the best out of anybody phoning him up. And on this budget day, he was talking to a middle-aged woman who was a great fag smoker, and she was absolutely wedded to her regular weed. And she was saying, oh, Dennis, she said, I don't know if they're going to put any money on a packet of fags. She said, well, that'll be the end of me. I've already got a bit of a throat, I know, but I can't do without them. And Dennis said, well, it's not really good for you, you know. I know. He said, just hold on. It's just coming up to 3 o'clock. He said, I think we better just
take the news bulletin. And just hold on, Violet, don't go away, don't go away. We'll see what's in the budget. And of course, the news comes up and there's a 10p on a packet of fags. And 2 minutes later, Dennis McCarthy goes back to the same caller who's still holding on to the phone. And he said, "Did you hear that, Violet?" And she said, "Oh, Dennis. Oh, Dennis, I don't know what I'm going to do." He said, "All right, love, don't worry." She said, "Well, it'll be the end of me." She was in absolute distress because of the 10p on a packet of fags.
Right, would you like to announce the record now and we'll play it?
The what? The Phantom Brigade, is it?
No, it's the Phantom Regiment.
Regiment, oh yes. Dear.
Hey? Yes.
Hey, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And when he died, they had a horse-drawn hearse through the streets of Nottingham. I wasn't there, and I wish I had been. I should have been. The streets were crowded. They were lined up, 2, 3, 4 abreast on either side of the street. For a radio presenter on a local radio station, somebody they absolutely lauded and adored because he was the master of his craft. Inevitably, in my job when I was controller of local radio, most of the phone calls that I received from around the country were to do with one crisis or another. Shortly after I became controller of local radio, I picked up the phone in my office and a voice said, "The flowers that bloom in the spring, tra-la." And the phone went dead. And I said to Elizabeth, my secretary, I said, "It's a very strange thing just now." She said, "Oh, well, it's probably to do with the war book." I said, "What on earth are you talking about?" She said, "Well, you know, there's a safe here in your office, and in there is the war book. And from time to time, they have an exercise." We're talking about Cold War time, by the way, still in the mid-70s. And I said, "Well, what happens when these experiments take place?" She said, "Oh, well, you have to read the war book. And that voice that you heard was probably Brigadier Ronnie Stonham, who is the BBC's emergency procedures guy in a hidden office in Broadcasting House, telling you you've got about, you know, a few minutes to read the war book and take action." I said, "Well, I honestly have no idea." She said, "Well, I tell you what, open the safe and you'll read the war book. It'll tell you what to do." And I said, "How do I open the safe?" She said, "Oh, well, the combination sequence is written on the back of the geranium picture." Where's that gone? "Oh, it's in your office, your geranium picture." I said, "You mean the one that was over the desk?" She said, "Yes." I said, "Well, I threw that away, I didn't like it." She said, "Well, that was Hughes." I said, "Well, I know, but I didn't like it." She said, "Well, he wrote the combination sequence on the back of the geranium picture." "Oh, God," she said. So I said, "Well, don't worry, I'll ring Hugh." "Hugh, you remember the combination lock?" He said, "Yes, it's on the back of the geranium picture." I said, "Look, Hugh, I haven't got the geranium picture." He said, "It's over your desk." I said, "No, it isn't. I've got rid of it." What was the number?" He said, "I can't remember." I said, "Well, was it written down anywhere else?" I said, "No." So I said, "Well, what do I do?" He said, "Well, you have to ring Brigadier Ronnie Stonham immediately and tell him you can't open the safe." I said, "Well, what's so important?" He said, "Because you have to take action in the event of a nuclear attack that involves every radio station in the country, and they have to go to their bunkers and broadcast to the communities who are being attacked by the Russians." I said, "Oh, for God's sake, Hugh, this is playing at war games." "No," he said, "it's serious." So I rang the Brigadier. Do you know what his first words were? "I'll have to tell number 10. I said, "What do you mean, tell number 10? Because..." He said, "If you'd read the war book, you would know that you're the first line of action in the event of a nuclear attack. Assume that the public have been given a 4-minute warning. They have to go into their bunkers and they will be listening to the radio." So, of course, it was a farcical situation. Eventually got a safe blower to unscramble the lock, open the war book, which then, of course, never mind 4 minutes, takes about 4 hours to read. Who invented this ridiculous system? I do not know. I was absolutely furious and bemused at the same time. Anyway, that was my first experience of a drama which I would never wish to repeat.
Good morning to you on the birthday of BBC Radio Lincolnshire. I've got two very good neighbours here in Lincoln. One of them's very old and the other's very young. The old one...
So we get through to the 80s and Alistair Milne has become the Director General, and he, again, having come in from television, was less familiar with radio. He had been controller in Scotland years and years before, and he liked the sort of regional feel, and he thought that England was a bit like Scotland, except that it was a bit bigger, and perhaps we could create regions in England for administration. He wasn't trying to get rid of local radio, but he was trying to administer it in a different way. So we're now into 1987, and he got me to sit on a working party to make recommendations, which in effect ruled my job out in the headquarters unit in London and replace it with regional headquarters, one in Manchester, one in Birmingham, Leeds, Bristol, and so on. And these would take over the administration of radio and television in each of those areas, which has a certain logic to it, except that I knew that it was going to put the bill up quite considerably, because every time you create a new headquarters, as it were, he needs his engineering support, he needs his, you know, audience research people, and he needs personnel, and etc. So I wrote a dissenting report, which Alistair didn't like, and he went ahead with his plan. So I was, along with all my headquarters staff in London, made redundant. So I bowed out in early 1988, and the regional heads of broadcasting came into power. However, I was not too surprised to discover that they didn't last all that long, because it was indeed getting very costly. I was upset, of course, by the circumstances, because I thought Alistair was wrong, and I told him he was wrong, and he knew that I was very passionate about not developing these regional centres. I wasn't actually saying it's my job that's important at all. I was more sorry, of course, for people younger than I, who were in my team, who, being made redundant at the age of 45 with a family and so on, is not much fun. So I started a new career. I was still only in my late 50s, and I was still quite keen on the broadcasting business, but ready for a change. And I went to BBC Enterprises initially to look after their nighttime downloading services. That is to say, at that time, in the late 80s, early 90s, we were not transmitting television programmes throughout the night, but there was space to hire out, as it were, to those people who wanted to have specialised programmes. And that only lasted for 3 or 4 years before, indeed, television started moving in throughout the night, so there were no longer any spaces left. Then I went to do Radio Goes to Town, which is a travelling radio festival, a circus top tent, which is a portable studio, and running a radio festival in about 27 different centres around the UK. And that was a bit of fun. Then I did the BBC Experience, which was the visitor centre in Broadcasting House, which the Queen opened in 1997. But the visitor centre did prove very successful until about 5 years after it had been opened. They needed the space for development, which is now what we now know as the main broadcasting centre, with Bush House and television and radio all lumped in together. So I had an interesting final flush after retirement and local radio, doing all these sort of novel things in the exhibition field.
This is BBC Radio Brighton, on the air for the very first time, over 2 months ahead of our official starting date of February the 14th. In fact, the weather conditions here are so severe and are having such a great and serious effect on our...
Do I miss local radio? I don't miss it, because I still listen to it. I have the advantage of... Well, my wife and I have a cottage in Suffolk, so we travel between London and Suffolk, so I've got radio stations there. I can listen to any station in East Anglia, or indeed, of course, I listen to any station in the country, digitally and on the internet, and I do that from time to time. So I don't miss knowing what local radio is doing. To be perfectly honest, I don't miss the work, because I'm now 86, and it's a distant memory, but a very affectionate one. And I'm so glad I did it. And it's another part of the broadcasting business I never expected to go into. It's all down to Frank Gillard, who started the whole thing. It was his vision. And he who gave us, and the country, an enormous service. And with it, ILR, the commercial service. Because together, I think we have provided a most wonderful alternative to the networks, who still have their place. And to me, the perfect balance is to pick and choose your own collection of stations. Maybe listen to a local station for part of the day, listen to a couple of networks for part of the day, download, record stuff, be your own controller, and enjoy. And that's what I try to do myself.
This is the first hometown radio station in Britain. It opens a new and, I think, exciting chapter in the story of British radio.
I think The Voice still has it. The voice that speaks to you when you're lonely and have no friends, few neighbours. I'm thinking of somebody who may be in their 80s, sitting in an apartment in Nottingham or Liverpool, and who doesn't want to fiddle around with an iPad or communicate with their children with text, but wants to feel part of the place in which they were born, maybe, and brought up. The voice of a local radio person is the most powerful thing on earth. And those are the sort of people that I think of who benefit greatly from that friendly voice coming out of a loudspeaker or maybe over a pair of headphones. And I think that will go on forever, that seductive relationship, because it's somebody who's just down the road. They breathe the same air, they catch the same buses that I do, they support the same football club that I do, they complain about the weather in the same way that I do, and they can bring me a smile when I'm feeling down. And who's going to replace that? And why would they want to replace it? Because we are all, after all, human beings, and conversation is part of the thing that keeps us going. And those who don't have that privilege through the workplace or through a big circle of friends, that's terribly powerful. And I'm not suggesting that local radio should end up simply as an aid, a social service to the less fortunate, but it is indicative of the strength and the power. And it can happen to younger people as well, of course, in their own way, to have that sort of tribal feeling of comfort through an association of place. And the best definition for me of a local radio station is in an area where the buses run, because that describes, beyond the final bus stop on that route, is somebody else's land, somebody else's community. So where the buses run, I belong. And my community is the people who breathe and talk my language and share the same sorrows and the same joys as I do. And that's local radio.